So, without further ado, I give you Mike Anderson, current California State Climatologist.
Thanks, Gary.
You're welcome there, sir.
All right. Good.
Jay got me one.
Good deal. I'm not sure it was on. All right. Thank you for listening this morning to an entertaining problem that I get to chew on, and it's called Estimating Future Floods to Manage Flood Risk. The state decided not only did we want to exceed expectations with today's floods, but we'll figure out what to do with tomorrow's floods as well. Millie's article about stationarity being dead seemed to have struck a nerve with... Here we go. Hi, everybody in the department, and so the strong interest and impetus driven by some legislative mandates to run with a 200-year event not only for today but tomorrow as well. So this talk, in some sense, is a kickoff of a process here to try and find a way to define a framework for flood management planning for the so-called 200-year event. So this talk here, we'll start with a combination of statistics, physics, and climate change all mashed together, stir it up, and then hopefully from there end up with a setup on discussion of flood management and 200-year event, and then set up some thoughts for you to chew on during the day while you listen to the other talks. So we take information from history, we figure out where we are now, and figure out where we want to go next. And so what is the 200-year event? Well, this, in my case, is a state-mandated target threshold for flood peak and volume for critical duration to use for flood management planning under current and future climate conditions. Well, that sounds simple, doesn't it? But what it is it's a threshold. It's in some sense, an arbitrary designation of a big enough flood that we'll choose to plan to and invest to that we think is a reasonable target for safety. The question is, what's reasonable? So what does a 200-year event look like? Well, first we'll look at a couple of maps from Mike Dettinger, who did some work with the Weather Service Cooperative Observer Network Observed Precipitation, and he looked at different thresholds. And if you look at 30 centimeters in 3 days across the U.S., you find there are really a couple regions where things get interesting. You have the Gulf Coast states who occasionally catch on to hurricanes coming ashore, tropical storms. And then you have the West Coast of the United States, but then you notice that there's only one place in the country where the dots get up into the 25 count for these kind of events, and that's California. And if you look really closely and you know your topography well, there's our points where we have some significant topography intersecting these events. Now we'll go to the bottom map, and we up the ante, and we go up to 50 centimeters in 3 days. And things fall out, and then you really have the big events on the Gulf Coast, but still in California, you still have those events, and you still have an area in the Feather River Basin that sticks out. And so pulling up in the Feather Basin, we look at Bucks Creek out of NOAA Atlas 14, and we do a 200-year, 3-day estimate. And the estimate itself is 23.5 inches of precipitation. So that actually jumps above our Category 5 event that Mike was looking at. But look at the 90% confidence interval. Ranges anywhere from only 18 inches up through 30 inches. That's a sizable difference in events to happen, but this is what data can tell us. When we look at Blue Canyon, we'll come down to the American River, and again from NOAA Atlas 14, and here we have 24.4 inches. So we actually end up with a higher estimate of itself, and the range is also still pretty large. We're looking at 19 inches going up to almost 32 inches. So again, we have a huge spread of what that estimate could be. And again, this is only the precip side of the puzzle. We haven't got to how it precip gets translated into runoff and how the atmosphere interacts with the watershed to create what we're really interested in. Well, here's a different view of what a 200-year event might look like. This is January 1st, 1997, and this is SSMI water vapor image, and this is a double-barreled atmospheric river that decided to come visit California. And you can see some pretty high totals getting upwards of 5 centimeters of water vapor coming ashore. So pretty doggone good flux. And we have a contribution from both the Western Pacific and the Central Pacific feeding in. Those are kind of the two major pathways for atmospheric rivers. In this particular event, we got both. And so we look at the 97 event and we say, okay, well, that was a pretty good sized event, but how do we get even bigger to get up towards that 200-year event? How big does that atmospheric river have to be? How much flux has to get thrown against the mountains for how long to generate the needed precip to make that happen? Now, here's the other fun event for statistical manipulation of data. If we presume each year is independent and identically distributed, year to year, we would kind of expect things to be the same. This is another image from Mike Dettinger, again, with the co-op stations of data, and he takes a standard deviation, divides it by the mean. And we can see that Mississippi River and East, not a bad assumption. In fact, that works pretty well. Starts to draw back as you go across the plains and head into the southwest. Things get a little sketchy. And then you get to California, and holy smokes. California truly is unique in terms of its precipitation variability. We can get nothing and we can get everything. And how to figure out how that type of behavior fits in when you're trying to describe something from a planning framework of in any given year, you have a certain percentage of something happening. This would indicate some years you've got a much higher probability than others. Trick remains to find out what drives that and how to make that work. Now, here's a plot I use to try and give people an indication of what on earth we're going to try and attempt to do here when we incorporate climate change into flood planning. 20th century of flood peaks for both the American and Feather Rivers. And pre-1950, you can see the statistics, max, min, and average, and you can see the post-1950. I'm designing and building Folsom Dam, we had a pretty good period of record in terms of statistical analysis. It probably met, thought, all right, we're doing pretty good. We built the thing, and then Mother Nature seemed to think it was a good practical joke to show, well, let's try this and see how this works. And that's it. We're asking now, given this history, how do you anticipate, plan, and operate to something you haven't seen that may look nothing like you've seen before? Throw in this the possibility, then again, this ties back to the notion of the Great Flood of 1862. Is there some multi-decadal fluctuation going on where you might fall into a 20, 30-year period where you're just not going to see a major flood peak? But then you may move into a different time period where all bets are off and hold on to your hats. It could be a real wild ride. Is there any information that we can use when we're trying to figure out how to do investments for flood management? Well, here's trying to play a game with statistics, again, trying to figure out in 50-year blocks how to deal with climate change. And it's playing with statistics, and we take all the statistics up to 1955, grind through the Bolton 17B process, compute 10, 15, 100-year event. Then take the whole 20th century, do the same events, and we see those estimates increased. And again, trying to communicate with people, the size of the 100-year flood is growing. And I think to some extent, you can probably condition the population to accept that. But then we try and say, okay, well, how do we figure out then the next 50 years? Can we just take the trend in the statistics and say what happened, the change in that 50 years, let's just say that same change happened again in the next 50 years. Something strange happens at the 100-year event if you do that. All of a sudden, the American River becomes capable of outproducing the Feather River. And then we have to kind of stop ourselves and check in with reality. And a Feather Basin's a much, much larger basin than the American. If it doesn't seem to make sense, then, that the American would produce a bigger flood at the 100-year event. So just merely playing with statistics isn't going to get us where we need to go. We need more information. And part of that deals with, again, some of the challenges in California. Not only do we not have one year looking like the next, we don't even have storms in our annual maximum that look anything like each other. We've got a good chunk of floods down that I call the dry years, where you'd be hard-pressed to call that a flood event. I don't think you'd have the operators at any of the reservoirs do anything. They took the year off, in essence, because there wasn't anything to manage. The flood peak was hardly enough to even probably fill up the hole in the conservation pool. Then you have these events in the middle where the snow level varies. You'd have a different size watershed participating in that runoff event. The bigger storm, you presume you have a higher snow level. You get more watershed area, it can contribute. Now, there's a cap to that. It's only as big as the watershed is. Once you get rain to the top of the watershed, the next thing you do is have it rain long enough for the rain at the very top, farthest part of the watershed to get to the outlet. And at that point, then, unless you're adding more rain faster, that's as big as things get. So again, there may be another puzzle piece here to play with and try and figure out what do we have. Well, let's circle back on to the atmosphere and figure out some work here from Marty Ralph that Dave had alluded to a little bit. And Marty says, the most extreme California storm would result from a rare alignment of key processes. So we got a bunch of things we're learning a lot about and trying to figure out how we can take this knowledge that we're gaining in terms of how an atmospheric river forms, what's going on in the Pacific that may influence that, in terms of waves moving across the tropics, the state of ENSO, Madden-Julian Oscillation, which is large-scale tropical convection that can excite planetary waves that may influence storm energy off the coast of California. You have cyclogenesis, which may be influenced by polar processes. Anyway, there's a lot of fascinating stuff going on here, and there are a lot of key phenomena. Now, we talk about an annual maximum flow, and we're playing with probabilities of that happening. Think about each weather event as rolling the dice on which of these coming up, or maybe if you want to think about it like a slot machine with different things rolling up, and do the different things come up, and you get yes, 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 boom, hello, you get a big atmospheric river event, you get a big flood. Do we understand these enough to start putting these pieces in place so you can start having little flags come up saying, this piece is in place, this piece is in place, this piece is in place. Okay, we've crossed a threshold, folks. You want to behave differently than you behaved before. If these other three flags fall into place, then we're really in for some heavy work. But here's the trick. How do you get from an atmospheric river flux to runoff, and in between you have to get to that QPF? And how does that flux interact with that nice picture of topography where you see ridge after ridge after ridge? The Sierra is a real fascinating place. You have areas where you get that convergence. You get enhanced precipitation due to orographic effects. In conversations with Marty, he tells me, well, then you also have this possibility of a barrier jet formation. And those dynamics seem to have an ability to enhance the rainfall in a particular band. Well, if these things are consistent, then there are specific parts of the watershed that behave in a particular way in an extreme event. Again, it's another process and another flag we can raise that help us get to the size of that supposed 200-year event. But here are some physical boundaries that instead of extrapolating and seeing that flow get off into 500,000, 600,000 CFS, I'm wondering, is that real? Watershed size and elevation. Again, rain could only go up to the top of the watershed. In the Sacramento Basin, it's already happened. San Joaquin Basin, the mountains are a little higher, a little different proposition, and trying to figure out how that happens. Again, each watershed's got its own unique shape and size and needs to be dealt with as a unique watershed. Yeah, the atmospheric river event duration. Large flux of water vapor in a very concentrated band, which means some watersheds get a lot, some don't get as much. How long does that last? Does it move? Does it get stuck? How many hours are you under that heavy precipitation event? Are there limits to an atmospheric river flux? Is there only so much the atmosphere can really pump in to California? And then are there limits on the flux to precipitation conversion process? In other words, our mountains are only so high. If the flux gets deeper, does that matter? Or is that just more water for the Great Basin? And how do we take that information and how do we try and drive that to help define these values that, again, we're going to come up with a flood that we decide is adequate to plan to and we protect people from? So now we have climate change and we look at the image my wife put together, just a nice graphic of all the different notions of our expectations of climate change, everything from increased air temperature, changes to precipitation, changes in our snowpack, sea level rise, all impacting timing and amount of river flows and the operations that we do to accommodate. On the right-hand side, I put an image of the annual precip in California to show you, again, huge variability spatially. And this is, again, in climate, we're dealing with long-term averages. In floods, you're dealing with an event. So how do I try and take information from climate and apply it to flood management? Well, first off, snow lines. As I mentioned, you have that middle part of the flood frequency curve where our snow level varies. In this image, kind of a depiction of where the snow line may move up to if you increase air temperature 2 degrees Celsius. And all this did was assume 500 feet of elevation gain for every degree rise in temperature. And these images were put together by Jane Schaefer Kramer in Francis Chung's shop in the Bay Delta office. But it gives a nice depiction of showing in the northern part of the Sierra, there's a large chunk of watershed that suddenly becomes available to rainfall. Again, the southern mountains are higher, a little more of the watershed protected from that early rise. More extreme climate change would change that story. Here's another way to look at climate change. This is observed temperature and precip going from 1896 to 2007, and you can see with the different icons the movement of the annual value. But again, this is all wrapped up in the annual value. But what it shows is that there is some migration into a warmer region. We see all the green triangles, with the exception of two, are all on the one end of the distribution. And we can anticipate that that will continue. But then I have the one highlighted down there, the blue square. It's from the 1930s where whatever happened there was significantly different than the years around it, which means Mother Nature can put something together that goes up to 3 standard deviations away from what you're already experiencing. Wow, okay. So I might be out there 2 standard deviations away from the total period of record, and then I go 3 standard deviations away from that. That could be a really interesting event. And if we understood why it got out there, we could have a notion of what to keep an eye out for. So here's some work Mike Dettinger did to try and take that first stab at how do you go from climate change into flood events? And we decided atmospheric river fluxes were probably the best vehicle for that. It's something that the climate models actually can represent. It's something you can get a distribution of under current climate conditions and something you can look at under future climate conditions. The drawback is you can actually count the number of squares that are the number of realizations that actually had this data in the climate models. How many people here feel good doing statistical analysis with a sample of 7? I didn't think so. How many of you would like to set a state policy on 7 pieces of data? Yeah, me either. Good news is the next round of IPCC climate change simulations are coming out, and actually a much greater number of them have this information. So we're going to be looking and seeing at how that informs the picture. But what you see, though, is that the distribution moves a little bit, but it does move up. So there is the indication that the atmospheric rivers can become bigger. And again, what happens when you get that 3 standard deviation event? 5 minutes? Good, we're almost there. All righty, well, it wouldn't be climate change if we didn't talk about sea level rise. And sorry, I don't have the latest and greatest from that. National Research Council just released its report this last week for the Pacific coast of the United States. And the notion is that, yes, there is an expectation of continued rise that does exceed what we've seen historically. And what we've seen historically, entertainingly enough, the Golden Gate tends to follow the global average pretty doggone good. That's nice to have an observation locally that matches a global average, so you can say, well, okay, if we project a global average, we have some expectation that Golden Gate may look similar. And if we do that, what does that mean? Well, that tells us what's happening at a Golden Gate. We still have to translate that all the way back in to the delta through the Bay system and figure out how then that becomes our lower boundary condition. And entertaining left, don't pay attention out of the delta for this particular part of the thought. But think about what that means in terms of water backing up the channels in our 2 major urban areas at the bottom of 2 very large watersheds, Stockton and Sacramento. And if you not only have this monumental amount of water cascading out of these watersheds, but coming down and hitting a backwater effect, that could create some entertaining challenges as well. All righty, so let's get back to my problem, managing floods in the 200-year event. So how do you manage a flood? Well, one, you have a monitoring network. You monitor for precipitation, and we're actually moving beyond that. We're monitoring for trying to monitor atmospheric river fluxes, so we can actually jump ahead of waiting for the precip to start falling to try and figure out how much fuel is coming into the state for the precip. Reservoirs, that is an interesting conversation I've had with people. You have designated flood storage that you have. A lot of people argue, well, you also have this notion of incidental flood space. And this is really interesting if you look at some studies. Jay's here somewhere in the room. And I think he noticed in a few of his studies that conservation pool tends to get sampled a little heavier under some management applications. So each year you dig beyond the top of the conservation pool, and historically we've seen that. That's all well and good, but that gives you protection from the first event because you can catch that water and keep it. I don't have to let it go. Okay, so that incidental flood storage space works for the first storm, but what about 1995? January was a fun event, but that wasn't all. And March comes around and said, hey, let's do it again. Separate with February, nice and dry, so people had the chance to start cleaning out and rebuilding. So it's an interesting notion of how to deal with possible notion of climate change that may impact what we're dealing with in terms of reservoir space, and how do you bring that in terms of managing flood and this notion of integrated water management. That's an interesting argument and conversation to have and to figure out how to put that into what you do. A major component of how we manage flood are levees. How big, what size, how to deal with all the issues that go along with levees and the geotechnical health and well-being of them and how you monitor and deal with that. Control structures and urban drainage. Here's a fun one, because the state will tell you that's not our problem. Stormwater management is a local entity issue, and that's governed by the EPA. That's not our problem. But how do you explain to people, well, hey, the levee's held from the event, but your house still got wet? So there's an interesting challenge to have, figure out where to draw that line in terms of management and who gets to handle what and how you work together to make that work. O&M considerations. It's all well and good to build something, but you have to keep it up and keep it up to speed for it to do what you think it'll do. We're dealing with that now, as we've told people. Yes, we built a flood control system. It doesn't look anything like it was when it was built, and it needs dire need of rehab. And then another one, a critical event duration determination, and this can go with both atmospheric rivers and what size flood governs your management of your flood management network. Both those pieces have to be dealt with and figure out how to put it together. Now, here's something that the state had put together in terms of trying to figure out what you have in terms of all these activities, whether it's a structural or non-structural component and possible climate change impact with it. Are you collecting the right data in the right place? What if you have increase your uncertainty? Oh, hey, great. Instead of a 12-inch range on our projection, it's now 15, 20 inches. That's even less useful when you're trying to plan for something. Water heights and volume turn out to be different than what you designed for. The inundation, arrival, and duration times suddenly become different in climate change. How on earth do you try and accommodate that? And again, you go back to that plot of the American River. How do you take one piece of data and anticipate the next and do it in a way where you're going to convince people to invest billions of dollars to do so? And the old data is not representative of future trends. All righty. So what we did with the flood protection plan, we did the threshold analysis approach, combining the notion of bottom-up, a vulnerability assessment. You know what your system can do, and you know where the thresholds are where things start to go wrong. Work that in with the usual top-down approach to climate change, where you try and figure out how much bigger and badder things get, and hopefully you meet somewhere in the middle to develop some type of adaptation policy. All right, so developing strategy. Try and figure out. I've picked three elements: peak, volume, and duration. With those three things, finding the critical thresholds that we have in the system, finding transition points. Where are those points where things line up and you start crossing things and you get into trouble? What adaptive capacity do you have? If you have people's backyards built to the toe of the levee, building a bigger levee may not always work unless you're really persuasive with the folks that live at the toe of the levee, or do something more drastic. Identify capital investments needed for both present and future conditions. Again, the future is in the future. There may be time to do incremental investment. Might be easier to do than telling people up front to invest a large sum of money for something we're not certain of. All righty, adaptive management. Figuring out your planning process and what your policy is going to be. More importantly, monitoring change. Getting a notion for how quickly things are changing. Is it going along expectations, and being able to find out if it's going faster than you thought? What do you do? Can you accommodate? Thresholds, timing, and transitions. Those are going to be key for California. Understanding how quickly things happen, what thresholds will get crossed, and how do you transition from one to another? How do you go from one particular distribution to maybe a different distribution if you're going to have that approach to doing estimation of flood peaks? And what about forecasts? Boy, there's a loaded question for you in every aspect of flood management. All righty, so uncertainty. As you can see, there's a whole bunch of it. We try and chip away at it. All these including changes in societal values. 10 years ago, who would have thought we'd be planning for a 200-year event, much less include climate change? All righty, so then we get to the panel discussion. We'll finish out hopefully not too late here, Gary. What information is available? We talked about a lot of things that we can bring information and physics to bear on this process to get beyond trying to put on our cat like Johnny Carson did when he did Karnak the Great and Divine. What are our important knowledge gaps? What do we still need to know? What do we have to answer to be able to employ that information in the planning framework? What challenges are there to adapting existing methods? You don't get either federal or state agencies to suddenly change direction wildly. That doesn't happen. So you do have to have a way to adapt what we do already and move in a new direction. And then finally, what have I missed? I'd be foolish to think that I thought of everything in this problem, and that's part of the reason I'm engaging you today. I've got a bunch of bright people sitting here before me listening to me, and I'm hoping that as you ponder this thought and you think about these things, hopefully this afternoon we can make sure that we've hit on some things that as I move forward in the next year, we come up with something we all look at and we say, that looks reasonable. At this point, I'll take questions. There's my email. Please feel free to email me with questions, comments, concerns, or whatever you wish to do.
Okay, Mike. All right. Are you going to be considering the use of paleo flood data and looking at the potential for your temperature flood?
Test. It's too late.
That's actually a fantastic question, and to try and figure out, again, to what extent we actually have data to work with. The paleo data I've seen for California works well with, again, looking at annual water volumes. Our blue oaks tend to be really good for that. Trying to translate that into the specific events, I know there are efforts where you look at sediment deposits and traces there. Something I need to look into more to figure out what exactly we might have in that area, but that certainly fits in with a lot of talks in today in terms of what data do we have from an event like the 1862, which, you know, has an almost legendary status. What can we actually pull from it? And paleo data, I think, falls into that category as well. There's information to be mined. We just have to figure out how to use it. Tim.
Mike, planning is going on.
Yes.
We are needing to have something to plan around. Where are you exactly? I was following you. We recognize sort of the limitations of the statistical approach that we've historically taken. You're beginning to integrate more physically based thinking into the characterization of 200-year floods, sort of back to the old Standard Project flood days.
Right.
But where are you exactly on settling on the 200-year event, for example, for purposes of our continuing planning at Folsom Dam, for example?
Good question. Well, we start with the Central Valley Hydrology Study, which is our statistical estimation, which we know right off the bat we're not entirely happy with that, but that is a starting point. And again, this gets to this point. You have to adapt to existing methods. But we can take that as a starting point and we can look and see what type of atmospheric river event creates that size flood. Then we can look at those boundaries and look at what's realistic. Now, again, trying to balance between the usual standard of practice and find ways to tweak it to bring more information to bear to help, I think, bring elements of that design flood in. So I have an idea in my head of how I want it to look. I want details to help fill it in so that it can inform it. Yeah, the Folsom Project's running along.
We kind of need something, Mike.
You need something sooner than later.
I understand
that. So that is the strong motivation to put this puzzle together. I've thrown a lot of pieces on the table here, and I'm hoping today's conversations can help give some organization.
And I don't think we or people in general would mind. This is our best estimate at this point. We understand this is a complicated topic. Things can change. But for purposes of moving forward over the next period, this is what we're going to assume.
And in answer to your question, we are at the Central Valley Hydrology Study.
Okay. Well, we look forward to your picking something.